Welcome to The Kinked Wire, the interventional radiology podcast from SIR Publications. You can learn more on our website, sirweb.org/kinkedwire. This episode provides audio abstracts of papers published in the June 2023 issue of SIR's Journal of Vascular and Interventional Radiology. You can find the full papers on jvir.org. My name is Romel Noche, and I'm your host for this episode.
Hello, my name is Jeremy Brown, and I am a transitional year resident at Kauai Health Medical Center in Visalia, California. I will be reading the abstract titled, Public Awareness of Interventional Radiology, Population-Based Analysis of the Current State of and Pathways for Improvement, by Rogers and colleagues. Purpose: to evaluate the awareness of interventional radiology, or IR, among the public and identify methods for improvement. Materials and methods. 1,000 participants were anonymously surveyed using Amazon's Mechanical Turk crowdsourcing platform about medical and IR-specific knowledge, preferred methods of acquisition of medical information, and suggestions for improving awareness of IR. The survey consisted of 69 questions, including both Likert scale and free text questions. Results. Of the participants, 92% preferred undergoing a minimally invasive procedure over surgery. However, 39.8% recognized IR as a medical specialty, and less than 50% of those participants correctly identified IR as procedurally oriented. Of the 113 participants who discussed or underwent an IR procedure, 66 were also offered to undergo the procedure performed by a surgeon. Furthermore, 71%, or 20, of those who underwent the procedure performed by a surgeon reported that lack of awareness of IR played a role in their decision. Almost half of the respondents were interested in learning more about IR, particularly the diseases treated and procedures performed, 42% and 37% respectively. Short educational videos less than 10 minutes in length and increased patient education by primary care providers were among the most suggested ways to improve awareness. Regarding the ambiguity of the name, interventional radiology, most respondents reported this to be true, and minimally invasive radiologist was the most preferred alternative by 21.18% of the respondents. Conclusions. Lack of awareness of IR may underlie underutilization. When presented with the knowledge that IR improves patient outcomes, minimally invasive procedures by an interventional radiologist are more often desired by the public than surgical options. Educational videos and patient education by primary care providers may increase awareness of interventional radiology.
Hello, my name is Sarosh Din, and I'm a third-year medical student at William Carey University College of Osteopathic Medicine. I will be reading the abstract titled, Radioembolization for Intermediate-Stage Hepatocellular Carcinoma Maintains Liver Function and Permits Systemic Therapy at Progression, by Ranganathan and colleagues. Purpose: to assess the liver function trends in patients with intermediate-stage hepatocellular carcinoma, or HCC, who underwent yttrium 90 transarterial radioembolization, or TAR, in response to a growing concern that liver-directed therapies negatively affect liver function and prevent patients with HCC from systemic therapy candidacy. Materials and methods. An HCC TAR database was retrospectively reviewed. Patients with Barcelona Clinic liver cancer, or BCLC stage B, and Child Pugh A HCC, with lab tests and imaging data at baseline and for at least 1 month after TAR, were included. Follow-ups were at three-month intervals. Child Pugh stage was assessed at each time point. Endpoints included time to persistent Child Pugh B status, time to Child Pugh C status, and median overall survival. Time to endpoint analyses were performed using the Kaplan-Meier method. Results: 74 patients, of whom 80% were men with a mean age of 63 years, with mostly bilobar disease, underwent 186 TAR treatments. The median time to second TAR was 2.3 months, and the median times to third and fourth TARs were 11.7 months and 17.3 months, respectively. 43 of the 74 patients developed persistent Child Pugh B HCC at a median time of 15.4 months. 17 patients developed Child Pugh C HCC at a median time of 87.2 months. The median overall survival censored to transplantation was 30.4 months. On univariate and multivariate analyses, baseline albumin was a significant prognosticator of overall survival, whereas baseline albumin and bilirubin were significant prognosticators of time to persistent CHOP-B-HCC and time to CHOP-C-HCC. Conclusions. In patients with CHOP-A-HCC who underwent TARE for BCLC stage B-HCC, the median time to persistent CHOP-B-HCC was 15.4 months. These findings indicate that patients would be candidates for systemic therapy at progression, if indicated.
Hello, my name is Joan Huang, and I am a third-year medical student at A.T. Stoll University School of Osteopathic Medicine in Arizona. I will be reading the abstract titled, The Effects of Protrusion into the Outflow Vein on Outcomes of Stent Grafts Used to Treat Cephalic Arch Stenoses in Dysfunctional Brachiocephalic Fistulae by Jones and colleagues. Purpose: to assess long-term patency rates of cephalic arch stent grafts in brachiocephalic fistulae and the importance of device position. Materials and methods. This retrospective study reviewed 152 patients with dysfunctional brachiocephalic fistulae and cephalic arch stenosis treated with stent grafts at a single tertiary center between 2012 and 2021. The median age was 67.5 years, and the median follow-up period was 637 days. A grading system of protrusion was applied. Grade 0, no protrusion. Grade 1, perpendicular. And grade 2, inline protrusion. Subsequent fistulograms were available in 133 of the 152 patients and were assessed for central vein stenosis within 10 millimeters of the stent graft. Clinical records were assessed for sequelae of stent graft protrusion. Stent graft primary and cumulative circuit patencies were calculated using the Kaplan-Meier method. Results: protrusion was documented in 106 stent grafts, 56 grade 1 and 50 grade 2. Central vein stenosis was seen in one case of no protrusion and 38 cases of protrusion. There was no significant difference in stenosis between grade 1 and 2 protrusion. No adverse clinical sequelae occurred in 147 patients. 8 patients had a new access subsequently formed in the same arm, and 3 of these 8 patients developed symptoms due to the previous stent graft protrusion, all grade 2. The primary patency rates of the stent grafts at 6 and 12 months were 73% and 50%, respectively. The cumulative access circuit patency rates at 1, 2, and 5 years were 84%, 72%, and 54%, respectively. Conclusions. This study demonstrated that protrusion of a cephalic arch stent graft into the central vein is safe and only clinically relevant when a subsequent ipsilateral access is created.
Hello, my name is Siddhi Hegde, and I'm a research fellow at Massachusetts General Hospital. I will be reading the abstract titled, 5-Year Outcomes of the Bioresorbable Peripheral Remedy Stent in the Treatment of Iliac Artery Disease by Obara and colleagues. Purpose: to evaluate the 5-year performance of a bioresorbable vascular scaffold, the remedy stent, for the treatment of iliac artery atherosclerotic disease. Materials and methods. This prospective multicenter single-arm clinical study evaluated 97 patients with symptomatic transatlantic intersociety consensus 2 type A or B iliac artery lesions for 5 years after stent placement. The primary efficacy endpoint was 12-month primary patency compared with the pre-specified standard derived from historical data with metallic stents, and the primary safety endpoint was the occurrence of major adverse clinical events within 5 years. All angiographic and computed tomography angiographic findings were evaluated by an independent core laboratory for quantitative vessel analysis. Results: the 12-month primary patency rate was 88.6%, which was lower than the pre-specified standard. No significant difference was noted between the diameter stenosis at 9 and 12 months. There were no device or procedure-related deaths, major amputation, or distal embolization during the follow-up period. The ankle brachial index maintained significant improvement throughout the 5-year period compared with that at baseline. The Kaplan-Meier estimates of freedom from target lesion revascularization, major adverse cardiovascular events, and major adverse cardiovascular and limb events were 95.8%, 91.7%, and 87.5% at 12 months, and 85.4%, 72.1%, and 62.5% at 5 years, respectively. Conclusions. The 5-year follow-up outcomes, including freedom from target lesion revascularization of the remedy stent in iliac artery lesions, were satisfactory, with a good safety profile. Nevertheless, the 12-month primary patency did not meet the expected standard compared with that of contemporary metallic stents.
Hello, my name is Mbir Singh Sandhu, and I'm a second-year medical student at the University of California, Riverside School of Medicine. I'll be reading the abstract titled, The Effect of Smoking Cessation on the Technical Success of Endovascular Treatment for Thromboangiitis Obliterans by Gondogmus and colleagues. Purpose: to show that smoking cessation improves the technical success of lower extremity endovascular treatment in patients with thromboangiitis obliterans, or TAO. Materials and methods. 102 patients with TAO who underwent endovascular treatment for chronic limb-threatening ischemia or severe claudication of lower extremities in a tertiary hospital between 2015 and 2022 were included in this retrospective study. Data on serum creatinine levels were available for the last 45 patients, and 38 patients constituted the study population. Per the institution's protocol, patients were instructed to quit smoking 15 days before the intervention. However, creatinine levels showed that some of the patients continued smoking. Technical and recanalization successes were assessed as primary endpoints. The secondary endpoint was the improvement in Rutherford scores at the one-month follow-up. The McNamara test was used to compare the proportion of recanalized arteries after the intervention. Results: 37 men and one woman were evaluated. The overall technical success rate was 86.8% in the study group. The technical success rate was significantly higher in the non-smoker group than in the smoker group, with a p-value of 0.006. One-month clinical data were available for 100% of the patients. The Rutherford category of the non-smoker group was significantly lower at the one-month follow-up. In addition, the Wilcoxon sign rank test revealed lower Rutherford scores after the intervention in the non-smoker group. The adverse event rate was 8%. One patient in the smoke group underwent a minor amputation. Conclusions: cessation of smoking before endovascular therapy improved technical success and recanalization rates in patients with TAO.
Hello, my name is Emily Barr, and I am a fourth-year medical student at Burrell College of Osteopathic Medicine at New Mexico State University. I will be reading the abstract titled Outcomes of Transarterial Embolization for Acute Non-Variceal Upper Gastrointestinal Bleeding, Correlation with Periprocedural Endoscopy by McGraw and colleagues. Purpose: to evaluate gastric and intestinal mucosal changes on post-embolic endoscopy and mortality after transarterial embolization for upper gastrointestinal bleeding. Materials and methods: an institutional review board approved retrospective review of patients who underwent arteriography for refractory upper gastrointestinal bleeding at a multicenter health system from December 2003 to August 2019 was performed. 269 patients underwent transarterial embolization for upper gastrointestinal bleeding. Data on etiology of bleeding, embolization technique, pre-embolic and post-embolic endoscopic results, blood product requirements, and mortality were collected from the medical record. Endoscopy results were compared at the site of the target lesion before and after transarterial embolization. Multivariable logistic regressions were performed to assess predictors of new adverse mucosal responses and mortality. Results: the most common etiology of upper gastrointestinal bleeding was peptic ulcer. 25% of the patients had clinical evidence of rebleeding after transarterial embolization, and the 30-day mortality rate was 26%. 88 or 32% of patients underwent post-transarterial embolization endoscopy, with only 15% showing new adverse mucosal changes after embolization. Procedural characteristics, including vascular territory and embolic choice, were not significantly predictive of increased risk of development of adverse mucosal response after transarterial embolization or increased mortality risk. No patients in the study were found to have bowel lumen stenosis at the time of post-transarterial embolization endoscopy or at six-year follow-up. Conclusions: transarterial embolization is a safe and effective intervention for patients with upper gastrointestinal bleeding. Post-transarterial embolization endoscopy demonstrated that most patients had either stability or improvement in the target lesion after transarterial embolization, and only a minority of patients demonstrated adverse mucosal changes.
Hello, my name is Yandri Varela, and I am a fourth-year medical student at Burrell College of Osteopathic Medicine. I will be reading the abstract titled Transjugular Intrahepatic Portosystemic Shunt Creation in Children Weighing Less Than 10 Kilograms Using an Unconventional Technique by Sanin and colleagues. Transjugular Intrahepatic Portosystemic Shunt, or TIPS, creation is a standard therapeutic procedure for the management of complications of portal hypertension. However, in small children, this procedure is infrequently performed because of technical difficulties owing to their small size and scarce information on outcomes. This article presents the results of treatment of variceal bleeding with TIPS creation in 8 children weighing less than 10 kilograms, along with a description of the unconventional techniques and materials required. Technical and clinical success rates were 100%. Although this was a small cohort of patients, the results obtained suggest that this is a safe and technically and clinically effective treatment option for complications of portal hypertension in this age group.
We thank everyone who helped with this episode. My name is Ramon Noche, and I was your audio editor. The research from this episode appears in the June 2023 issue of JVIR, and you can visit jvir.org for the full papers, other audio content, and much more.